back in the 70s that visit them. I wasn't even there yet. They are they're art historians. John is the director of national media relations for Syracuse University, but that's only a small percentage of his involvement here. They're both adjunct staff, faculty rather, at SU. They are the authors of Edison, Musicians, and the Phonograph, which some of you may be familiar with. It's a large volume of interviews with people involved in the recording industry from the earliest years. And I forgot to bring a copy, but most of you probably are aware of it now. So they're both writers, students, musicians. They're very heavily involved in what we're all about, and they're going to talk to you about some of the interviews. I think some that didn't make it into the book. There's enough for another book, but some very interesting meetings and interviews they have done with more people in this field. John and Susan Harvath.
Actually, we did bring the book.
Surprise.
Surprise, just so, in case you haven't seen it, it's still in print, Greenwood Press, if anybody's interested, but horribly overpriced, but we had nothing to do with that, so don't blame us.
There's a 20% discount for arts members, though.
Oh, really?
Oh, wonderful.
Hey, well, that's wonderful. Keep that in mind.
And I think there are only about 30-some left, so, I mean, we're trying to get it published in paperback. And that's more affordable. We'll see if that happens.
And actually, we'll talk about, you know, we have a few little bits of information from interviews we'd like to include if we do get to do a second edition. To begin with, we thought we'd just talk a little bit about how we got involved in this whole project. I've loved recordings all my life from the earliest time I can remember. I had a little phonograph, had children's records to begin with, and then found some old 78s around the house and became wildly in love with classical music, and then got involved with loving early popular music on 78s. Susan?
Well, I came to recordings through my interest in film history at a very young age, after old films had finally been released to TV and had a whole new audience. I became interested in them and in the opera films of Grace Moore and Lawrence Tibbett, et cetera, that came out in the 30s that gave opera a new audience. That was kind of the segue into collecting 78s. And John and I actually met because of our mutual interest in 78s.
It happened one day at Wayne State University when we were both sophomores. And Susan was working in the listening room, the audio room at Wayne State University. I was a student who had transferred from the University of Michigan, just walked in and was transfixed. There was this huge long wall glassed in of 78 recordings, and I was just glued to them. And Susan walked across the room. The room was filled with tables with headphones and turntables with students intently listening. She walked up to me and patted me on the back and said, "Psst, psst. You know, those aren't LPs. The LPs are over there. Those are 78s. You can't really do much with them." I said, "I know what they are. I collect them." And she said, "Well, who are some of your favorite artists?" And I said, "Well, Geraldine Farrar." And she shrieked. She literally shrieked. And I had to put my hand over her mouth and did that. And all the students looked at us, and they were really annoyed. And so we had to walk out of the room. And that's how our relationship started. It was a slow-moving romantic relationship. It took about 7 years of going to concerts, collecting records, looking at old films. But we finally did join forces.
The interesting thing is that while we were working on our Edison Musicians in the Phonograph project, which culminated, of course, with the book, we also had an exhibition, I think you've seen a poster for it, and a series of symposia at the University of Michigan. And in the midst of all this, I discovered that I was pregnant, and our one and only daughter was born in 1978. We didn't plan it that way, but it's easy to remember. and she shares our mutual passions.
Right. So, at any rate, Susan was pursuing a master's degree at the University of Michigan and did an internship at Henry Ford Museum.
Yeah, part of the requirement for getting a master's degree at U of M was to serve a year's internship in a neighboring museum. And because I was interested in history, mine, of course, was Henry Ford Museum, Greenfield Village. And in the midst of that, you had to submit three possible topics for your master's thesis. And they would just pick whichever appealed to them the most, not necessarily your first choice, whatever. They, of course, picked the Edison recordings because they had received all of Edison's material when the company went under in 1929. It had passed to Henry Ford Museum, and Henry Ford, rather. And they were interested in having it cataloged. That was their primary focus. But this kind of launched an odyssey of adventures that culminated with the book. It took us, as Sue had mentioned, to Syracuse University. They gave me, listen to this, folks, $200 for a traveling stipend. It didn't get us much farther than the Belfer Audio Archives, but that was just the start. We started there with Walter Welsh, and then we went on to the lab in New Jersey and poured through original hands-on research, the actual memos, company memos. This is not microfiche. This is real material here. The card catalogs that had Edison's little remarks on artists and repertoire, and of course dealing with test pressings. And then we launched our interviewing phase of it by starting essentially with company personnel that was still surviving in the West Orange area. And Theodore Edison, Edison's son, was one of the first interviews we had.
Should mention when we were here at Syracuse, it was before it was Belfer, so it was the basement of the Continental Can Company. And Walter Welch spent 2 days with us. It was fascinating because what he told us was to ignore Edison's memos and tune book comments. That this really, that's just all, so much made up and, don't think about it. And of course, as soon as we saw the stuff, we realized that wasn't true. But the thing that was really valuable about Walter is that he explained to us what he was doing in re-recording and then explained to us what made the Edison recording sound so brilliant, which was Edison did not believe in room resonance entering the recording. So therefore, what he tried to do was to have recording situations where there would not be room resonance. All you got was the voice, the sound of the instrument or singer coming out at you. The place where the phonograph was would supply the artificial resonance that would go with it, which we found corroborated when we went there. And that's how we met Ray Weil and traded all sorts of information. He was very helpful to us when we were there.
So at any rate, we began by talking to, among other people, Theodore Edison. Kind of took our breath away when we met him because he was like a slender version of his father, the same hair and everything else. At any rate, then we went into New York City and talked to Anna Case, and she was one of the first people, Edison's favorite vocalist. We have a few things that we kind of wanted to share with you before we did some of the things that were not in the book. Just referring to some of our notes now, when we began to examine Thomas Edison's attitudes towards music and recording and his unsuspected involvement with every aspect of the record company, including, of course, the selection of artists and repertoire, we were just amazed at the comments we were finding on these file cards about artists who we knew through the recordings and loved, Claudia Muzio, Margarita Matzenauer, Rachmaninoff, etc. And then we sought out the surviving artists to hear their attitudes toward Edison and the way he recorded things, his approach to music, and what he was trying to achieve. It was fun because a lot of this is, if any of you have done this kind of research, know that people who are out of the limelight, it's hard to track them down. Sometimes they want their privacy. In other cases, they're just not famous enough for anybody to have kind of kept track of them. So it involved a lot of sleuthing, which we really loved, trying to find people like Anna Case. Ernest Stevens, of course, was almost right in our backyard there in Montclair, New Jersey. We talked to Donald Voorhees. These, of course, are all people who recorded for Edison. Irving Kaufman, probably the most recorded popular singer on recordings and recorded for many labels, of course. Violinist Samuel Gardner, Arkady Birkenholz, Louis Kaufman, who we got to know very well along with his wife, and we'll be sharing some thoughts with Annette, et cetera, later. We broadened our horizons. We didn't want to just stick with Edison. Those of you who might know us personally know that we're kind of obsessive compulsive people, and we never know when to really call it a wrap on what we're doing. And we thought, well, let's see if we can find musicians who recorded for other companies. Of course, you had to do acoustical, then we had to go up to date with electrical and that on there with Lotta Lehmann, Rosa Poncel, Alexander Kipnis. We tracked down the famous artist management person, Arthur Judson, and we kept going more recently and recently, not only with musicians, but also with behind the scenes people, engineers, producers, coming right up to now, and thought for good measure we just throw in Muzak, because Edison had started this whole utilitarian use of music, and we thought that was a wonderful kind of full circle approach to it. It was hard to wrap it up. This is from 1971 to 87, and it essentially led us to do the oral history of the phonograph that was published in 87. And it also led us to the realization that the commercial recordings everyone assumed represented the purposeful and enduring legacy of musicians. This is something we felt very passionately about. Obviously, we were not around to see Farrar and Mary Garden and those early people, and this is how we knew them. Something that we had always accepted as a trustworthy legacy was in fact, in many cases, a battlefield between the musicians and the Edisons of the world, the technocrats, who trusted the principles of engineering, perfection, technical limitations, and prescribed and easily explained standards.
The musical artists that we talked to were trying to put across musical ideals and communicate through recordings as they would to an audience, and they resisted the kinds of limits that the technicians were determined to impose. Recordings, which were commonly accepted then by critics, historians, and the public as the legacy of a musician, the permanent embodiment of what a performing artist did in the concert hall, were regarded skeptically by many of the musicians we talked to. There was disagreement between them about the value of recordings as documents and even the desirability of making recordings and having them available. Although some liked the recording process in their own recordings, a number did not regard their recordings as being representative of their work as performing musicians. Among them, Lotta Lehmann, Nicholas Harnoncourt, Edison pianist Ernest Stevens himself, the Guarneri String Quartet, they all expressed reservations about recordings. The musicians we interviewed regarded recording as an ancillary activity with live performance of paramount importance. What we strove to provide and felt was missing in the historical literature at that time was a source book of information on what musicians thought about the recording process, whether it changed their performances, whether they thought their recordings represented faithfully what they were intending to communicate as musicians, what they thought about the ethics of editing, what they could recall about the mechanics of making recordings, what they had to say about live versus studio recording, what they had to say about releasing imperfect but exciting recorded performances. Edison, the pragmatist, when he took charge of his own recording company, looked for those qualities he prized most in his practical world: technical perfection, predictability, homogeneity, a certain, to him, satisfying and reassuring dullness. No theatricality, no hint of uncontrolled passion for Edison. In short, Edison's values, which became the values of too many recording executives after him, were values prized in the pragmatic technical world and antithetical to those of most artists who enter the recording studio.
Edison began a concept that's persisted to this day, the concept of recording as a medium separate from live performance. The technical process, in his view, demanded the absence of the concert hall or opera house ambiance or the live performance chemistry that takes place between musicians and audiences. He did not want to hear the scraping sounds made by overly exuberant string players or the thumping noises made by virtuoso pianists carried away by the emotion of the moment. These values became prized in the CD era when, without tape hiss Every seemingly insignificant sound assumes unwanted prominence.
Edison may have thought that he was capturing all there was to a performance by reproducing in a clear and undistorted fashion the voice of a singer or sound of a pianist. But the stage personality, personal magnetism, and concert hall atmosphere, which he consistently debunked, the phonograph is not an opera house, he once declared, seemed to be precisely those qualities many musicians we interviewed regarded as essential to a proper understanding of their artistry. Too many recordings, both from the Edison Company and companies of today, are more notable as technical achievements than as engrossing musical documents. Edison labeled composer-pianist Sergei Rachmaninoff's bravura piano style as pounding, faulted Mozart for lack of invention, and filtered musical sound from a mechanical point of view, catching defects, mistakes, and extraneous noises, but missing the niceties of interpretation that constituted the greatness of legendary musicians like Rachmaninoff or John McCormick.
From a mechanical point of view, music is in pretty bad shape, Edison told one interviewer. And in another article, he stated, music is in the same backward state today that electricity was 40 years ago. I'm going to develop that. I hope to complete the task within 3 years. Music lacks definite terms by which time may be indicated. Music is too noble an art to be thus handicapped. It should not be that only the composer knows precisely the time in which he wishes his production to be played. Music should be established upon so scientific a basis that anyone who can play at all can play a piece in precisely the time that the composer intended it should be. And in place of all these relative terms like faster and slower, there must be rigid and definite terms. And establishing certain definite musical measurements, I am going to do for music exactly what I did for electricity when I invented machines to measure it. I shall yet put before the world a phonograph that will render whole operas better than the singers themselves could sing them in the theater. I shall do this by virtue of the fact that with a phonograph I can record the voices better than any person in a theater can hear them.
Edison, via what we've been hearing last night and yesterday, Edison foresaw equipping a piano with a recording mechanism that, quote, would make it possible to reproduce upon a piano similarly equipped the same composition and reproduce it in precisely the same manner that the composer created. But music, which some commentators have called the noblest of the arts and the one art form that actually conveys to listeners what it felt like to live in the era in which a musical composition was created, was never intended by composers to be a fixed, unalterable object. Music was intended to be a living, breathing, malleable entity. This is how masterpieces stay fresh and pertinent to new audiences, always there to be reinterpreted, to be made new, exciting, and meaningful to present and future generations. As Aaron Copland told us, quote, at the moment you write down a tempo indication, you think it's fixed. But sometimes, as a composer, you hear a version that you think is better than your own conception. You never can be certain you're going to think the same way about a piece of music 10 years later as you did at the moment you wrote it.
One of the major lessons to be learned from Edison's encounters with music is that of filtering. Right now we have to filter that upstairs noise out of this. As University of Michigan ethnomusicologist Judith Becker said to us, we used to think that people had something like objective hearing. We now know that hearing as well as seeing is a learned thing. You hear what you've been taught to hear, you see what you've been taught to see. We all know now that there are innumerable parts of our world that we don't see, which we do not listen to, and we don't hear.
Another major lesson to be gleaned from all of this is that in learning to filter, we train ourselves to think and absorb life's experiences, artistic and scientific, across disciplines. Understanding that there are important communications encoded in great works of art that obey their own rules and appeal to different areas of the mind than the pragmatic and technical areas which so preoccupied Edison. And yet technology has made possible the preservation of great musical performances and the creations of great filmmakers when artists and those in technology understand one another and the nature of their respective disciplines. As conductor Bernard Haitink told us, to be a successful recording artist, you must, quote, think with your heart and feel with your brain.
Some of the greatest musical recordings ever made have been those captured faithfully by gifted engineers and producers who understand the messages musicians are trying to convey and allow musicians to perform freely and passionately as if they were before a live audience, with imperfections and extraneous noises thrown in. We were able to interview so many prominent musicians, we think because they told us no one had ever bothered to interview them strictly about the recording process, and they considered this an intriguing and important topic. And the differences in personality apparent in the interviews, we strove as far as possible to retain an individual flavor and a conversational style in each of them, was perhaps reflected in the ambience of the interviews. Lotte Lehmann, for instance, who kept postponing the date of our interview in her Santa Barbara home, purposely scheduled the time of day to be late afternoon when the sun would shine in at just a precise angle in her conservatory, where she was seated in her wheelchair, which actually looked like a throne, with the sunlight coming in and beautifully backlighting her hair, next to a glass vase of seemingly dozens of long stem roses. It was obviously an interview that she was very serious about keeping. And interestingly enough, when we were doing the book, we would send our interview to each of the people to have it approved. In some cases, some of the people had died. So Lotte Lehmann's interview went to her longtime friend, Dr. Frances Holden, who kind of reluctantly approved it because she admitted that it did reflect Lehmann's views about recording, even though they were surprisingly negative and very cavalier in the way she approached it.
Rosa Ponzel, on the other hand, entertained us poolside at her crumbling Maryland estate, wearing a bathing suit, and she had us wait until she completed 10 laps in her pool before beginning the interview, as her pet cats were purring next to her. She really did consider recordings her legacy and was cheerful and carefree about expressing her feelings. The forthright and blunt Arthur Judson, who at one time was the most powerful concert manager in America and probably the most powerful concert manager of all time because he managed the Philadelphia Orchestra and the New York Philharmonic at the same time and also managed all the people who performed with them, including Ormandy and some of the other conductors, pulled no punches in his interview. For instance, when asked about managing the New York Philharmonic under Toscanini, he said, quote, "A conductor is a man whom God created to convince the manager he doesn't know a goddamn thing." He presented a really striking picture out of Citizen Kane. He was a massive man, tall, you know, maybe about 6'4", imposing, amazingly youthful looking for his 93 years. He looked as though he were in his 60s. He was ensconced in a law school-sized oak-paneled library with plenty of shelving but very few books. He was seated at a rickety card table in the middle of it, listening to a ball game on an old transistor radio while playing solitaire. And this was in the midst of a Westchester Country Club mansion with a baronial marble hallway and all the fixings. His wife, who was much younger than him, insisted on sitting in on the interview. And when she disliked us asking Judson about Yasha Heifetz, she simply pulled the plug on the recorder and said the interview was over. And after that, he said, "Please come back another time. I never get anybody visiting me. I don't know why."
You should tell him about the address. Interestingly enough, we really didn't have a proper address for his house, so it's a miracle that we ever found it. And when we did come up to the door, we kept ringing and ringing and ringing the bell. I think it was at least 15 minutes. And right overhead, we could hear a woman who indeed was his wife chattering on the telephone. She was doing everything she could to have this not happen. And then there was Anna Case, who was one of our first interviews, who became a very close friend of ours. And we were staying with my family in Connecticut. We finally got her on the phone. She had actually been hospitalized, and we thought, oops, we've lost this opportunity. But she had broken her hip. But she came home, and we talked to her on the phone, and she said, okay, come on, right, come, come over right now, get in a cab and come over. We had to explain that was a train ride. We had schedules and things like that. We might be about an hour and a half later. At any rate, we finally got off, and some of you, I think, can appreciate this if you've been in this field a long time. We did these interviews with a reel-to-reel tape recorder. Betty Davis always said that her tombstone should say something like, she did it the hard way. Well, we did it the hard way, too. Our book was pre-computers and everything else. Anyway, so we're running through Manhattan with our reel-to-reel tape recorder, and we pull up in front of her house, and she's actually she's out in front of the brownstone on the pavement, looking down the street. She lived on a one-way street. She was looking the other way for a cab to pull up, and we were out of breath after running 10 blocks because we thought she was at the Stanhope.
She told us she was at the Stanhope. Yeah. She switched the address.
At any rate, we had a marvelous time with her. Afternoon turned into evening, and we caught the last train back to Connecticut. John is a pianist, and he walked over to her Mason and Hamlin and played a few notes, and she got up, went over, and started singing. She hadn't sung in many, many years. And of course, she was one of those supporting players. She played Michaela in Carmen to Caruso and Farrar.
So
she was 83 years old. She started singing in the solid, strong voice, exhibiting wonderful technique, and we've got it on tape too because we kept that tape recorder going, and just opened up to her, and we were just astounded because we really felt that we were in the presence of what those voices really were like in that earlier era. And again, she wasn't a Farrar or a Caruso, but the solidness of technique was certainly there. She was a down-to-earth person who many of you may know that had Mary Clarence Mackey, one of the great multimillionaires of that period, who had been founder of Postal Telegram and was chairman of the board of the Metropolitan Opera, the Metropolitan Museum at the same time. At any rate, and had amassed a large collection. He died about 7 years after they got married. Unfortunately, he insisted that she retire. She had been a wonderful radio personality at that time. And in view of his early death, it was a real tragedy because at that point, enough time had elapsed, she couldn't kind of rejuvenate her career. Anyway, she was in the midst of Flemish tapestries, Boucher's, Cellini busts, and everything else. Talked about her rivalry with her step-son-in-law, Irving Berlin. Anna Case, it turns out, was a composer too, and she had some sheet music, the Song of the Robin, which she sang for us, and some other things.
Some of the renowned musicians that we tried to reach, alas, either died before we could reach them, had little of importance to say, never responded to our queries, or flat out refused to be interviewed. Jazz pianist Teddy Wilson, for instance, wanted a cut of our profits for his interviews. We explained that there were no profits. We were doing this as a scholarly project. He was not interested in talking any further then. Duke Ellington said he was working on his own autobiography and would not be interviewed, and the same with Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau. Lionel Hampton was perfectly charming and invited us up to his elegantly appointed apartment, since destroyed by fire, unfortunately, but had virtually nothing of interest to say, just that with today's mics, quote, you could hear an ant whisper. Nathaniel Shilkret was, quote unquote, protected by his son, who refused to let us interview his father unless we signed some sort of financial agreement with him. Heifetz never responded to our letters requesting an interview, and although Segovia agreed to an interview, we did not realize we needed an interpreter, so about all he could express in English is that, quote, recording is torture for an artist, which producer Thomas Frost said he was sure was true for Segovia, who insisted on playing compositions through without editing.
Among some of the other people we interviewed and did not get into the book but may get in next time was Misha Violin. Now, some of you probably have seen that name and thought it was made up by Edison, but there really was a man named Misha Violin, and he was a child prodigy who came from Europe. He actually performed a Berlin debut with the Berlin Philharmonic under Nikisch. He'd had a London debut as a teenager playing the Tchaikovsky Concerto at Queen's Hall under Sir Henry Wood. He had his U.S. debut in 1917. He remembered when he recorded for Edison that Edison was present at the recording session, and it was in New Jersey, and oddly enough was done on cylinders, and that Edison was actually looking at the cylinders through a magnifying glass with a smile on his face. He had submitted all of his compositions, short compositions, in his repertory, and Edison picked out those compositions that required very little vibrato. things that were very fast and would not require much vibrato, and therefore that must account for the smile on his face. Violin had a long career. He ended up scoring and conducting for motion pictures and movie theaters, and ended up in Las Vegas as the concertmaster of the Sands Hotel and other places in Las Vegas, together with his wife, Jeanette Violin, who was the concert mistress of the other casinos.
That's true.
Another Edison artist that wasn't in the book, but maybe next time, is Paulo Gruppa, who studied for years with Casals in Europe. He gave the American premiere of the Schumann Cello Concerto. He made his U.S. debut in 1909. He remembers in 1910 playing for Edison, and he still would have been a teenager, and approached him with the idea of inventing stringed instruments with mechanical bodies that would resonate more forcefully for acoustical recording. And he attributes that suggestion to Edison, with Edison coming up with his own little orchestra for all instrumental categories of these sorts of things. He claimed that they weren't Stroh violins Edison was using, that they actually were these things that Edison had come up with himself. Anyway, he said his first Edison recording was made with a horn about as big as the trunk of his body. He was 5'6" tall, and he said, you know, I'm not accounting for his head or legs, it was a huge horn, and therefore he didn't have the kind of trouble with his bow, he was able to do it. Apropos yesterday's talk about vibrato, and talking about famous violinists, whether any of them ever used a Stroh violin, we interviewed Eugene Ormandy. He would not, tacitly, he didn't want certain things in the interview. He didn't tell us directly. He just rejected the interview with the material in it. When we submitted it without it, he okayed it. At the beginning, and it talked about his early career, playing for motion, you know, picture theaters and all of that. He said that the recordings that he made for solo violin were done with a Stroh violin. So if anybody wants to study those recordings in the Cameo label in Brunswick, whatever, and you listen to that, you'll find out what better violinist playing with a Stroh violin as a soloist sounded like and what the vibrato was like.
20
recordings.
I did the discharge.
Very good. So he used a Stroh violin to make those, he told us, but he didn't want it in the interview. We interviewed Jano Antal, who is the second violinist of the Roth String Quartet, which made the last Edison recording, the Debussy Quartet, when it went out of business. He told us that with Edison, often the cello was sitting a little away and high in a small podium, away from the microphone. And he also told us that Roth, who had a string quartet earlier in Europe, when they recorded, they had separate horns for each of the four stringed instruments and mirrors so that they could coordinate with one another, which is kind of an interesting setup and something unusual. And what else do we want to say? We're running out of time here. I think the other thing is piano rolls were mentioned yesterday, but not classical. And the one person we talked to who did classical piano rolls was Abram Chasins, who mentioned that he had made some duo arts with a man by the name of John Woods. I'm not a historian of those sorts of things, but people out there may know. And he said that he just thought they were dreadful. They were made in the best possible way. And he said none of the piano rolls you ever heard properly represented the artist because they distorted rhythm, no matter what. And these were on the machines of the time. So take it for what it's worth, but that was by someone who actually recorded at that time. And did you want to say anything?
No.
Okay. The other thing is that from the time we've done the book, there have been changes in views of some of the musicians. And one of the most noticeable one is that with Nicholas Harnoncourt, Franz Bruggen, the Guarneri, they all said they didn't really want to do live performance recording. They didn't want the mistakes in there. With Harnoncourt, he said that it was a different experience. He didn't want to do all the experimentation in concert that he had on records because it would just be tiresome to hear over and over again. Since then, they've changed their minds. And they are now doing live performance recordings and presumably don't feel strongly about not doing live performance recordings. So it shows that there really is an evolution, future work for people to do as oral historians in this whole area. This whole area constantly evolves, and what we wanted to do is provide people with what was going on at the time. Mm-hmm. But I think our time is up, unless people have questions.
One quick one, Irving Kaufman.
Oh, yes.
He's a Syracusan.
That's right. I'm sorry we didn't mention him. He was born in Syracuse in 1890.
Right. And I'm just wondering if you had a quick observation of your interview with him.
charming man. He had to retire in 1949 after a severe heart attack, but made a ton of money. He told us that Edison was the first firm to let him in the door, and after that, all the other firms followed, and he just never signed an exclusive contract. He would record from like 8 in the morning until the evening, every day going from one company to another. He would have people just play him the music. He would do it by ear. He would constantly be able to do back. He mimicked voices. They purposely had him imitate people like Al Jolson, John McCormick, The Brogue, everything else, just in order to compete. He claimed he sold more of Sonny Boy than Jolson did by recording for so many different labels, for instance. But anyway, he actually sang for us. He was constantly popping nitroglycerin pills, but he actually got up. His wife is an organist and pianist. Yeah. We actually have him on tape singing for us at the age of 80-something, whenever, you know. Yeah.
Don Wetzel used to work with Ormandy and the Philadelphia Orchestra and broadcasts, and he said one day he started to ask him about the OK Electrics, and Ormandy just shut up and stormed out of the room. He did not want to admit that he had ever made those
records. Right.
That's right.
And Fred also had tried to speak with Nat Scherzer.
There are three of us who collected, I know, the Ormandy records. Roger Blackburn had the same experience as Don Wetzel. Ormandy almost kicked him out of the orchestra. He was furious.
I was very lucky that he didn't do that. You know, just lucky that he didn't react that way. But later on, when we submitted it, he didn't want to pass the interview, so we just intuited that if we took that out, he would pass it, which he did.
You also had not been able to get a hold of Nat Scherzer because of his son, right?
No, not because of his son. I had Jesse Lasky and Nat Scherzer in the same room at the University of Michigan.
Really?
With Ravelli.
Well, what year?
That was quite an experience.
What year was that?
1952.
Oh, wow, early. Before his son was shepherding him. Yes?
Is the Kaufman interview in your book, and is he the only popular performer you interviewed?
He is in the book. He's not the only popular person we interviewed. Ernest Stevens is also in the book. Benny Goodman is in the book. We also interviewed Eileen Stanley. It was a telephone interview. She was very busy, didn't have much time, but we may include excerpts of that if we have another edition. There are a few other people we tried talking to and just wouldn't do it, or they died. You know, those sorts of things happen. We tried Elvis Presley. He wouldn't see us. You know, with popular, we tried a rock producer, and he backed out at the last minute because he had an engagement paying him money. That's the way it is with a lot of the popular artists. Yes?
One of the living legends today is a member of this organization. His name's Wilford Graham.
Yeah.
And he's responsible for between 40 and 50 for recordings at RCA.
Oh, well, that's good to know.
But he was one of the closest friends of Irving and Bell Kaufman.
Oh, great.
And we've already had him on local radio interviewed in Philadelphia, one of those small stations. I have tapes of that. There's a guy that we ought to get up here and tell us all about.
That would be wonderful.
Presentation.
That would really be wonderful.
Are you
going to stick around?
Yeah, we'll
stick
around. We're here.
That's true, we're on the program later.
That's right.